And so we're going to spend the rest of our time looking into objections to predictive prophecy. I think we've narrowed it down to five objections here. Okay, objections to prophecy. Let's look at our first objection. What if Jesus self-fulfilled these prophecies? Okay, you've got Psalm 22, Daniel 9, Isaiah 53. Jesus was a Jew. Jesus had a Hebrew Bible. How do we know Jesus didn't just open up his Hebrew Bible, say, yep, I can fulfill 1, 2, and 3, and the other ones I could say I fulfilled? And how do we know Jesus didn't just self-fulfill these predictions? This was the view of New Testament critic Hugh Sconfield. This is back in his seminal book, The Passover Plot. It was also turned into a movie. He writes this: Jesus, quote, had applied to himself what was written in the Old Testament, and he duped his, quote, untutored disciples. This was this critic's theory, that Jesus applied these passages to himself, and his, you know, Acts 4:13 says that his disciples were not well-educated and well-read, so he just duped his untutored disciples. They didn't know any better, and they just believed that he fulfilled all these prophecies. What if Jesus self-fulfilled these prophecies? Well, there are a number of problems with that. First, many of these prophecies were beyond Jesus' control. For example, his place of birth, Micah 5:2. His method of execution, Psalm 22:16. He didn't get to pick how he died. He didn't get to pick where he was born. The men gambling for his clothing, Psalm 22:18. His burial in a rich man's tomb, Isaiah 53:9. He didn't get to pick where he was buried. And most importantly, his time of death. I'm going to argue later that the disciples could not have fulfilled that prediction, and neither could Jesus. But we'll just have to postpone that to later on in the study. Secondly, crucifixion wasn't in Jesus' self-interest. So there were some, is that an understatement? There are some prophecies that he couldn't have fulfilled because they're beyond his control. But crucifixion wasn't in Jesus' self-interest. This is the way that Roman statesman Cicero, he's a first century BC Roman, writes about crucifixion. Cicero writes, a most cruel and disgusting punishment. To bind a Roman citizen is a crime. To flog him is an abomination. To kill him is almost an act of murder. To crucify him is what? There is no fitting word that can possibly describe so horrible a deed. So Cicero describes crucifixion as just the worst possible fate one could endure. Josephus, a first century Roman Jewish historian, referred to crucifixion as, quote, the most wretched of deaths. He had seen thousands of Jews crucified, and it was just so disturbing to him, he called it the most wretched of deaths. I'm not going to belabor this point. If anyone's seen the Passion of the Christ or done any study into what crucifixion was like in the first century Roman era, it was a brutal, a disgusting way to kill somebody. The Romans were perfecting how to kill people. They were expert executioners, and they got this subject down to an absolute science. Our modern word excruciate literally comes from the Latin prefix ex, meaning out of or from, and cruciate just is the root from which we get crucifixion. So literally the word excruciate means out of crucifixion, out of the cross. This was a horrific way to go. Third, Jesus not only had no physical motive in being crucified and killed, he had no theological motive for being crucified. You have to remember that in first century AD, Palestinian Judaism in the first century, the Jews were anticipating a conquering king, a reigning ruler who would come and kick the pagan Romans out of Israel the way that they had done under the Maccabees. They were expecting the Son of Man of Daniel 7:13. They were expecting the King of Kings, Isaiah 9. The government would rest on his shoulders. A political ruler would come and rescue them. They were not expecting a crucifixion victim to be the Messiah. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1:23 that the cross is foolishness to the Gentiles and it's scandalous to the Jews. The Greek word is scandalon. It was a scandal that we would preach about a crucified Messiah. I'd be like saying Superman got a paper cut. The Messiah doesn't die. The Messiah kills people. He doesn't get killed. So if Jesus was trying to self-fulfill these Old Testament prophecies, why would he pick the prophecies about the conquering king, the ones that everyone was expecting? Why pick the ones that were against his own religious milieu, his own environment? George Ladd is a scholar from Fuller Seminary. He writes that Judaism before Christ never interpreted Isaiah 53 as referring to the sufferings of the Messiah. They didn't believe this was referring to a suffering Messiah. They believed it was talking about the servant who they thought was somebody else. They actually thought it was two Messiahs, Messiah ben David and Messiah ben Joseph, one that would suffer, one that would reign. They thought this was somebody else. So why would Jesus pick passages that weren't considered messianic? I mean, just think about it. If you were a messianic imposter, not only would you prefer to pick the passages where you'd be a reigning king and have people worshiping at your feet, Psalm 2, but your whole culture would think that was the way it was, too. Why would you pick the ones that weren't messianic? OK, so that's why Jesus couldn't self-fulfill these prophecies. Objection two. Well, maybe it wasn't Jesus who self-fulfilled these prophecies. Why would he want to do that? Why would he want to be strung up and crucified? Well, maybe it wasn't Jesus. Maybe it was the disciples. Perhaps the disciples self-fulfilled these prophecies. They put Jesus up as a patsy. They had him killed. They made up this story about the resurrection. And then they said that he fulfilled all these prophecies. Here's the way atheist Victor Stenger writes about it in his book, God, the Failed Hypothesis. He says each of the prophecies is confirmed in no other place except in the Bible. We have no independent evidence that events actually took place as described. So you see, the New Testament fulfills the Old, but how do we know that they were telling the truth? Maybe they just made that up. Stenger writes, lacking any independent corroboration, we cannot take the New Testament as evidence for a single fulfilled Old Testament prophecy, much less 61. We can't get a single fulfilled prophecy here because the New Testament authors wrote all this and they just took that from the Old, but it's not corroborated anywhere else outside of the New Testament. Well, that's the silliest thing I think I've ever read. I don't know if that was a statement of ignorance on Dr. Stenger's behalf or a statement of dishonesty. Either way, that's embarrassing for him to have that in print. That is so obviously false. I can't believe he wrote that. I literally read that quote when I got to that point in his book and thought, I can't believe he's in print writing this. Many of the facts about Jesus can be attested outside of the New Testament. Here's just a string of extra-biblical, hostile, non-Christian historians who also mention Jesus and the facts corroborating his life. Tacitus, Pliny the Younger, Josephus, Lucian, Mara Bar Serapion, Suetonius, Thallus, and the Babylonian Talmud all reference Jesus of Nazareth and the core details about his life, his ministry of miracles, his death, and some which even refer to his speculated resurrection, placing him in the exact same time frame with the same details that the New Testament gives. So you have to ask yourself a question. Were all of these Roman, Greek, and Jewish historians all part of this conspiracy too? They were all trying to tip their hat to what the New Testament authors were saying in fulfilling these prophecies? It's ridiculous. Secondly, the disciples didn't have a motive for self-fulfilling these prophecies here. Think about it from just the political and the religious environment of first century Palestine. The Romans hated Christianity. They weren't favorable to it. The disciples were, under this view, inventing a new religion which was hated by the political environment. And under this view, they were inventing a view that was hated by the religious environment. So if it wasn't the cop that was coming after you, it was the priest. You had the threats of the religious environment and you had the threats of the political environment. All this garnered for the early disciples was a big fat target on their foreheads. They had no motive for doing that. Jesus's closest disciples went to their death, which we'll argue next week, believing in Christ. And they also lived humble lives. They lived humble lives. They didn't get rich. They didn't get powerful. They lived below the radar. They didn't have a motive for self-fulfilling these prophecies. Third, the disciples would have feared divine judgment if they were deceivers. The disciples were all first century Jews. They believed in the Old Testament. They quote or allude to the Old Testament 600 times in the New Testament. They were Jewish men. If they were making up a religion that was false, if they were tampering with or altering the Old Testament, the disciples would have believed that they were going to incur divine judgment, which was taught in the Old Testament. Yes, it was. Isaiah 26 refers to the general resurrection of the dead. Ezekiel 37 and Daniel 12:2. It says that all people will be raised, some for judgment and some for life. The disciples would have thought that they were going against Yahweh God. Now, the critic will come back and say, yeah, but I don't believe in divine judgment. I believe when I die, I'm just going to rot in the ground and become worm food. And that sort of a threat wouldn't bother me at all. Yeah, that's true. But you're not a first century Jew. They were. They believed in these sort of things. This freaked them out. That would have bothered them to believe this if they were lying. They were taking an eternal risk in propagating this view. Fourth, and this is a little bit controversial. This is my own theory. I haven't heard this argued by anyone else, so it's a little bit controversial. Let me see what you guys think. I'll test it on you. Fourth, Daniel 9 wasn't understandable in the first century. Do you know how many times the New Testament authors quote Daniel 9, 24 and 26? None. They don't quote it once. Jesus quotes Daniel 9, 27 in Matthew 24, 15, talking about the abomination of desolation. They knew it was in the Bible. They knew it was a prediction. They knew it was there. But the messianic portion of Daniel 9, 24 to 26 is never once quoted. Let me put that in comparison. The New Testament authors quote Psalm 22 no less than 25 times. They're all over it. They quote Isaiah 53 no less than 40 times. They never quote Daniel 9, 24 to 26 once. Moreover, the New Testament authors never give a date for the fulfillment of Jesus' death. It's not as though they said he died in AD 33. Now, we can figure out when Jesus died by doing historiography and piecing everything together. We can get Tacitus' time period for being under the reign of Tiberius and Pontius Pilate. We can compare that with Luke 3:1, which says that Jesus was under the reign in a specific year of Tiberius and Pilate and all these other different players in the first century. We can nail it down to 33 AD, but the New Testament authors never say that. It's almost as if Daniel 9, 24 to 26 wasn't a strong apologetic for their time period because they didn't have the historical method. It was next to useless in their time period. The church fathers, if you study this subject, didn't use Daniel 9 as a messianic prophecy for over 100 years after the time of Christ. Here are two theological journal articles which discuss how the church fathers handled Daniel 9. They don't get this right until after the 400s. They're all over it. They're trying to understand this prediction. They're trying to find its fulfillment. They all have a different perspective on it. But all of the church fathers, they don't come up with the right interpretation of Daniel 9 until far past the Council of Nicaea, hundreds of years later. The New Testament authors knew this passage existed. The church fathers knew this passage existed, but they couldn't find its fulfillment. Even the enemies of Christianity knew about the prophecy of Daniel 9. Even the enemies had a copy of Daniel 9. Tacitus refers to Daniel 9 as being fulfilled in Vespasian, or Titus. He came in and conquered the city of Jerusalem. Josephus and Suetonius believed it was about the emperor as well. So Josephus wasn't a believer. He was trying to handle Daniel 9, didn't know how to fulfill it. Suetonius knew about Daniel 9, didn't know how to fulfill it. Tacitus had it, didn't know how to fulfill it. Okay, the enemies had it, but they didn't know how to fulfill it. What about the rabbis? The 3rd and 4th century rabbis, they must have known that it was being fulfilled sometime in the 1st century. Rabbi Rab said, in about the 4th century, he said, what delays his coming, the Messiah? He says, quote, all the predestined dates have passed, and the matter depends only on repentance and good deeds. That's from the Babylonian Talmud. So in other words, they knew that the general time was in the 1st century. And you have a lot of messianic figures arising at that time, specifically in the Jewish war. So you have the enemies of Christianity know that the passage existed, but they don't know how to find its fulfillment. Early church fathers know it's there. They don't know how to find its fulfillment. The New Testament authors have it. They don't know how to find its fulfillment. They didn't have the historical method, so it was next to useless in their day. But then we have to ask the question, if this prophecy wasn't for them, then for whom was it written? Isn't it obvious? This prediction was written for us in an era of history when we can know the historical method and piece all of these things together. Think about that from another perspective, okay? This is kind of a multifaceted thing once you realize it. Kind of wrap your brain around it. If the New Testament authors were faking the fulfillment of Daniel 9, don't you think they'd be shouting this truth from the treetops? If I had faked the world's greatest predictive prophecy of all time, I'd be telling people like crazy. They don't quote it once. It must have meant that this prophecy was not in there for them. It was meant in there for us. Objection number 3. Were the prophecies written before Christ or after? This objection. Were the prophecies written before Christ or after? Well, let's just go with the entire Old Testament. Let's start here. When is the entire Old Testament finished by? Let's ignore all of the conservative dating for the Old Testament books. So we're going to ignore Gleason Archer's just incredible work on Old Testament survey. We're going to ignore K.A. Kitchen. We're going to ignore McDowell. All these guys who have this wealth of body of information that shows that the Old Testament books were written when they claim to have been written, hundreds of years before Christ. Let's just throw all that out the window. Let's only go with what the skeptical critics say of the Old Testament. That's not even fair. Let's just say that that's true. Well, first, the Septuagint, the Old Testament written in Greek, was finished by 132 B.C., roughly 150 B.C. The Septuagint was a Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, finished by roughly 132. We have excerpts of the Septuagint from the book of Deuteronomy that date, I believe, to about 150. So sections of Deuteronomy that go back that far. Secondly, we have the Dead Sea Scrolls. Well, what are the Dead Sea Scrolls? This was a body of manuscripts found in the Dead Sea. The story is that there was a young boy herding his sheep, and to scare some of the sheep out of a little cavern, he threw a stone into a cave and he heard a big crash. And he went inside the cave and he found these big clay pots in there. And he looked inside and found these scrolls wrapped up. He thought he could make some money off of it. Contacted people in the city. It turned out to be the greatest biblical discovery of the 20th century. An entire plethora of scrolls that date back before the time of Christ. In there, we have two important documents. The first document is the Manual of Discipline, which was an Essene document. The Essenes were Jews who were off away from traditional Judaism and the temple worship. And number two, the Zadokite document. So they have these two important documents, Manual of Discipline, Zadokite document. Well, what do these say? When they quote the Old Testament, when they quote the books in our Hebrew Bible that both Jews and Christians affirm, they use the expression, "it is written," or "God said," only when quoting canonical books, books that belong in the Bible. Now, that expression, "it is written," "God said," looks familiar. Who else said that? Jesus, a first century rabbi. Whenever Jesus would quote the word, he would say, "it is written," or "God said." So these Jews quote only from our Hebrew Bible. The Dead Sea Scrolls not only contain full books of the Old Testament, but they quote from every Old Testament book with the exception of poor, poor, poor Esther. She always gets the shaft. Poor Esther was not quoted in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So the Dead Sea Scrolls quote from every Old Testament book except Esther, and they date before the time of Christ. Third, we have Josephus, a first century Jewish Roman historian. Josephus had a complete copy of the Hebrew Bible. Okay? Now, that was expensive. That was an expensive gift to have. I believe it was the general or the emperor gave it to him as a gift, just the entire Hebrew Bible. And when Josephus refers to the Old Testament, he says that he had in his hands the exact same Hebrew Bible that we do today in our modern Bibles. So Josephus is not a believer in Christ. He's just a first century Jewish historian. And he says we have the exact same Bible that we do today. Here's what Josephus says, and against Appian: "For we have not an innumerable multitude of books among us, disagreeing from and contradicting one another, as the Greeks have." That must have been a first century joke. We're not like the Greeks over there. They got all sorts of stuff they're reading. Not us. "But only 22 books. Wait a minute. I thought that there were 39 books in the Old Testament. Well, you have to remember, he had the same number of books, but they were bound differently. Jeremiah and Lamentations were put together because they were written by the same author. Judges and Ruth were put together because the story of Ruth takes place during the era of the Judges. There was no such thing as 1 and 2 Samuel. It was just Samuel. There was no such thing as 1 and 2 Kings. It was just Kings. 1 and 2 Chronicles was just Chronicles. Ezra and Nehemiah was supposedly written by the same author. And then the 12 minor prophets were all broken up by Christians, but they're all put down as the prophets. So when you do all the math and you combine the way he bound his Bible, he has 22 books. He had the same number of books, but he just broke it up differently. He says, "which contain the records of all the past times, which are justly believed to be divine. From Artaxerxes to our own time, the complete history has been written, but has not been deemed worthy of equal credit with the earlier records." Why? "Because of the failure of the exact succession of the prophets." Artaxerxes, let's just use round numbers, around 400 BC. He says, from Artaxerxes to our time, well, there's been history written, but they haven't been considered canonical books. They're not inspired because they weren't written by prophets. because of the failure of the prophets. And our Hebrew Bible ends with Malachi, Ezra, Nehemiah, Malachi, and then it picks up with the Gospel of Matthew. There's a period called the Silent Era, and Josephus is referring to that. He's saying there haven't been any prophets, so we don't have any extra books. That's why the Old Testament Hebrew Bible stopped there. Josephus adds, "For although such long ages have now passed, no one has ventured to add or to remove or to alter anything. It is an instinct with every Jew from the day of his birth to regard them as decrees of God." We don't add books capriciously to our Bible. We don't take them away. They're viewed as inspired, and they have been for 400 years. Then finally we have, fourth, New Testament attestation. The New Testament authors allude to or cite the Old Testament roughly 600 times. The New Testament is just steeped in the Old Testament. These were first century Jews who were quoting their Hebrew Bible. There is much manuscript evidence for Daniel 9, both the book of Daniel as a whole and the specific prophecy of Daniel 9, 24 to 27, which predates the time of Christ. I'll just give you three sources. Number one, there are Essene commentaries on Daniel 9. You had the Pharisees or the Pharisaic party, which were the Jews, then the Sadducean party, which were Jews, then the Zealots, they were kind of the fighters, and then you had the Essenes that were just so sick of the hypocritical temple worship. They were sick of the Pharisaic party and the Sadducees that were denouncing Scripture. The Essenes were kind of an apocalyptic Jewish group that moved off into the Qumran community near the Dead Sea. And they were kind of separatists, ready for the end of the world out there. Well, the Essenes wrote a lot on predictive prophecy. So we have two documents here, the Testament of Levi and the Pseudo-Ezekiel document. Both date to 146 B.C. And they both mention Daniel 9 because they were all over Old Testament prophecy. Number two, we have the Melchizedek fragment, which dates to 50 B.C. It states, quote, "And the messenger is the anointed of the Spirit about whom Daniel spoke." Well, the anointed one is mentioned in Daniel 9:24, and it says specifically Daniel's the one who mentions him. It's got to be referring to Daniel 9:25. And then third and finally, we have eight manuscripts of Daniel that date to 100 B.C. Eight manuscripts of Daniel that date to 100 B.C. at Qumran in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, these aren't complete manuscripts. Those first two examples are specifically of Daniel 9, but these eight manuscripts are just the book of Daniel as a whole, but they haven't been preserved perfectly. Now, Peter Flint, who is an expert in the Dead Sea Scrolls, in his book that he co-authored with Craig Evans, it's called Eschatology, Messianism, and the Dead Sea Scrolls, we may conclude that seven scrolls originally contained the entire book of Daniel in a form very much found in the received text. What he's saying is this: the manuscripts that we have, seven out of the eight from the Dead Sea Scrolls, are almost identical with the Masoretic text, which is 1,000 years later. That's how well preserved they were, the pieces and parts that we do have. James Vanderkam, whom I consider to be a critical scholar, I emailed him when I was doing research for this and said, "I'm doing research for this subject, and I just wanted to know where you stand. Are you conservative, moderate, or critical?" And I would have said he was critical. He came back and said, "I'm a moderate scholar, if you want to know." However, I got to point out, he doesn't think the book of Daniel was written by Daniel. He thinks it was a pseudepigraphical work from 167. He thinks it was written in the 160s during the Maccabean Revolt. So I have to consider him to be critical, not a believer. Now, that means nothing in the book of Daniel was inspired, as it claims to be. And it wasn't written by Daniel, as it claims to be. So He's a critical scholar. He says this: all eight scrolls reveal no major disagreements against the Masoretic text from these eight documents of the book of Daniel. Now, they're not complete, but the portions we do have are exactly what we have in the Masoretic 1,000 years later. And we have commentaries and people quoting Daniel 9 from before this period. So that's the book of Daniel. Well, we already talked about Isaiah 53 last week. In the Dead Sea Scrolls in Cave 1 of Qumran, we have a 24-foot scroll of the entire book of Isaiah, all 66 chapters. You know, I bet when that was found, I wonder if some of the believers were biting their fingernails wondering, is it going to go from chapter 52 to chapter 54? Hope we didn't put that in there, some scribe. Don't worry about it. Dates to 150 B.C., the entire book of Isaiah was there. And it's almost identical with the Masoretic text. In some places, it's word for word. Sometimes words are just a little bit different. But think about that. That manuscript was preserved for 1,100 years, almost word for word identical with the copy, the next earliest copy. Then we have Psalm chapter 22. We have two manuscripts that predate the time of Christ. Two manuscripts that predate the time of Christ for Psalm 22. Here again is Peter Flint. This is from his book just on the Psalms, the Dead Sea Psalms, scrolls in the book of the Psalms. He has charts up of all the manuscript data, and you can go through and see how many manuscripts we actually have for this book. Flint records two manuscripts of Psalm 22, one from the Dead Sea Scrolls and one from the Judean Desert. He dates them at least to 50 B.C. in two separate regions from two separate religious communities. They date far before the time of Christ. Just to let you know, this is not some kind of Christian conspiracy, if I didn't make my point already. Here's Jim Lippard. This is off of infidels.org. This is a highly skeptical, atheistic website. This is on from his article called The Fabulous Prophecies of the Messiah, where he tries to take down Bible prophecy. He writes this: prophetic statements do not post-date the events being predicted. They do not post-date, which means they predate. In the case of the Old Testament prophecies, we have documents, for example, the Dead Sea Scrolls, which do predate the time at which the historical Jesus is believed to have lived. So that's as skeptical as you can get. Even he is saying it's just obvious these prophecies were made before Christ lived. If you want to go after the subject of predictive prophecy, the manuscript evidence is not the way to do it. You get embarrassed. Norm Geisler describes it this way. He says, what difference does it make if a prophecy is given only 200 years in advance rather than 600 years? Can one with less than divine power make predictions like these 400 years in advance, but not 600 years ahead? Good point. It's a very good point. Let's just go with the critical dates. What do the critics say the date of these books is? Well, let's just say it's 200 years in advance. Is that any less phenomenal, any less supernatural? I think not. Objection number four. Were these predictions just lucky guesses? Again, our boy, Victor Stenger, from God the Failed Hypothesis, page 176. We have no risky prediction anywhere in the scriptures that's come true. Of course, preachers have disingenuously told their flocks that many biblical prophecies have been fulfilled. Reason number 47 why I distrust Victor Stenger. I'm so suspicious of his work. I've mentioned before, he publishes with just atheistic publishers, at least not on his stuff on physics, but his stuff on atheism, Prometheus Books. That would be like someone only publishing with a Christian publisher. So he only publishes with highly skeptical publishers. And in his chapter on predictive prophecy, what floored me was that he didn't touch, didn't cite, didn't mention Psalm 22, Isaiah 53, or Daniel 9. He He said Psalm 22 has been fulfilled in verse 1. My God, why have you forsaken me? That's the only thing he quotes from Psalm 22. He says, well, Jesus could have just read that psalm that day and said it that day when he got crucified. He fails to go on and read the other 30 verses in that psalm, which are far more predictive. He doesn't touch Isaiah 53, and he doesn't even refer to Daniel 9. I am incredibly suspicious of his work, and I just don't believe a word he says. I'd rather get it from some other atheist that's more credible. Here's Norman Geisler. He says, it's been calculated that there are roughly 191 prophecies in the Old Testament about the Messiah. These would include where he would be born, Micah 5:2, how he would die, Isaiah 53, when he would die, Daniel 9, and then he would rise from the dead, Psalm 16. The odds that just 48 of these prophecies were fulfilled in one man is 10 to the 157th power. That is a 1 with 157 zeros after it. Now, this has been critiqued by the skeptics because they say, well, that's 48 prophecies, and how do we know that those are all predictive? And some of those are fulfilled in the New Testament, and they can't be backed up extra biblically. And these stats here are taken from a group called Science Speaks, which was a Christian group. They came up with this 110 to the 157th power. So this has been criticized. I don't really know if the odds are 10 to the 157th power. What I do know is that these prophecies are highly unlikely. And I don't know if it's that figure or not, but I do know that it is pretty far-fetched to say that this whole thing was just by pure chance. Give me a break. What about objection number 5? Aren't there prophecies like this in other religions or from psychics? Here's Farrell Till. He's a skeptic. He used to be an evangelical pastor, lost his faith and became a skeptic. This is from his article, Prophecies Imaginary and Unfulfilled. Till writes, if then Old Testament prophets did on occasion foresee the future, a questionable premise at best, perhaps they were merely the Nostradamus and Edgar Cayces of their day. You know, the Bible has predictive prophecy, supposedly. Let's just say that that's true. But, you know, there's other prophets and other religions that also have prophecy. And maybe these prophets were just these psychics in the Old Testament. Maybe that's all that this was. Well, I'm not an expert in world religion, but I am a student of it. I've studied it quite a bit. And I've challenged people to give me some kind of prophecy from other world religion that is anywhere close to biblical prophecy. I've never been able to find anything on it. What I'd like to do is just give you some of the prophecies that people have brought to me that they claim are as good as biblical prophecy. Let's start with Quranic prophecy, prophecy from the Quran. What about Muhammad? Didn't Muhammad make prophecies that are on par with biblical prophecy? Here's a Muslim apologist, Ansar Raza. This is from his article, Fulfilled Prophecies of the Holy Quran. Raza writes, quote, no one can ever imagine that an unlettered person living in a nomadic society of Arabia 1,400 years ago can predict such amazing scientific events. I used to work with a friend of mine. We worked together. He was a Muslim, and he said that, you know, the Quran has tons of predictive prophecy, just as good is in the Bible. It predicts scientific events you wouldn't believe. I said, well, would you show that to me? He said, yeah, my uncle can get a few of those for you. And so he tracked down all of the verse notations and all the surahs, the chapters in the Quran. And I got to look through them. And I studied this guy here, Raza, who also advocates this view. Raza writes, it's very well beyond the human capacity to foretell, even visualize such incredible incidents. The only conceivable source of these prophecies and predictions must be purely divine. Well, what I'd like to do is just read through some of these prophecies, which he says, the only conceivable source of these is purely divine. Now, I'm just going to read through these, and I'd like to see what you think. You can judge for yourself if you agree with his statement. This is the first one. He says, the Quran predicts fingerprint identification. Okay? We read about this in Surah 41:21. It says, quote, their skins will bear witness against them, as to what they have been doing. What about genetic engineering? This is from Surah 4, 120. They will alter Allah's creation. What about roads and mountains? Surah 81:4. And when the mountains are made to move, that's predicting roads and mountains, apparently. What about transportation systems? Surah 81:5. And when the she camels, 10 months pregnant, are abandoned. Surah 16:9. And he has created horses and mules and asses that you may ride them, and as a source of beauty, and he will create what you do not yet know. That's predicting transportation systems. What's the prediction? He will create what you do not yet know. Okay. Zoos for various animals. Surah 81:6. And when the wild beasts are gathered together. That's predicting zoos. What about this one? Modern communication. Surah 81:8. And when various people are brought together. Wow, that's very specific. What about air traffic systems? Surah 51:8, and by the heaven full of tracks. He said, look, it predicts it right there, hundreds of years in advance. What do you think? Ask yourself, is the only conceivable source of these prophecies and predictions purely divine? I'll let you decide that. I'm not going to weigh in on that. I have my own thoughts on that. Let me just give you three criteria for Quranic prophecy that I noticed from each one of those. None of these prophecies are specific. None of these prophecies are significant. And none of these prophecies are supernatural. The best one I thought was the fingerprint one. Their skins will bear witness against them. It says nothing about fingerprints. It doesn't say how they'll bear witness against them. It could refer to a number of different things. So they're not specific. That's probably the most specific one. Number two, they're not significant. You're saying that the inspiration of this holy book rests on its predictions about zoos? Zoos and fingerprint analysis. That's not significant. On the contrary, when we open up the Bible, we have global, worldwide, significant life and death matters being described. The destruction of Jerusalem, the regathering of Israel, the gospel reaching all nations, how Christ would die, what would happen after. We're talking about significant world-altering events. And none of these prophecies are supernatural. When he says that the only possible source is purely divine, I fail to see that. That the animals will be brought together. You couldn't have said that in the 7th century in an agrarian society. When you're around animals, you couldn't say that you're going to bring them all together. I could have predicted that. Okay, what about Nostradamus? Nostradamus is brought up, I think, on the History Channel just about once a week. They love Nostradamus. Nostradamus was a French physician and astrologer who lived from 1503 to 1566. Michel Nostradamus fought the bubonic plague in his community, losing many of his patients. So he was a physician and astrologer, lived in the 16th century. He fought the bubonic plague. Many Nostradamians, as they're called, believe that his prophecies are flavored against this historical backdrop. That he lost many of his patients and he saw a lot of people die and grow sick. And so a lot of his apocalyptic prophecies are set against this backdrop. In his so-called centuries, that's not referring to a period of time, but 100 quatrains. A quatrain, if you know your Shakespeare, is a four-line stanza. So he has these centuries, which are just 100 quatrains. Nostradamus makes a gazillion predictions throughout his centuries. Going up to, I think, 3500 AD. So we won't be able to exhaust his prophecies for a very, very, very long time. Right around 4000 AD, if that helps you remember. That's Nostradamus. That's his background. Well, after September 11th, the internet was just on fire with Nostradamus' prediction about September 11th. Here's what many websites read, picking up on Nostradamus' predictions. Now check this out. In the year of the new century and 9 months, the new century, 2001, 9 months, September, from the sky will come a great king of terror. Terrorist from the sky. The sky will burn at 45 degrees. Fire approaches the great new city. 45 degrees. New York City is right near 45 degrees. And there will be fire in a new city, New York City. Then it said, in the city of York, there will be a great collapse. Two twin brothers torn apart by chaos. While the fortress falls, the great leader will succumb. Third big war will begin when the big city is burning. Now, I don't know about you. That's pretty good. I mean, it gives the time. It gives a terrorist at the location in this new city. And then it says the city of York. These two twin brothers come down. I mean, people, after they read this, were freaking out. That's pretty good. There's just one problem with it. It's a complete crude fake. Nostradamus never wrote this. Even supporter Ian Wilson, in his book, Nostradamus from 2003, writes that these were crude fakes. You can go back and search through Nostradamus' writing and search in vain to find these quatrains in there. But there was some truth in this prediction. The first quatrain was actually a combination of two separate quatrains from Nostradamus' writing. Quatrain 697 and 1072. So the first line there was taken from one part over here, and the second two lines were taken from over there. The second quatrain was just completely made up. They completely invented that, but they spliced these other ones in there so that maybe a Google search would show up some of it. Here's Edgar Leone's translation of that first quatrain I cited. So you see what I said there? The first part is from 697. The second part is from 1072. Let's look at 697. This is from Edgar Leone's translation 20 years before 9/11 ever happened. This guy is not in any way biased. He's not trying to make it look like it was about 9/11 or make it look like it wasn't or whatever. Edgar Leone translates it this way. And this is the foremost Nostradamian scholar on earth before he died. Everyone tips their hat to Leone. He is the number one scholar in Nostradamus studies. Century 6, Quatrain 97 writes, at 45 degrees, the sky will burn. Fire to approach the great new city. So there it is, the location and the new city, New York. In an instant, a great scattered flame will leap up. Right there, that's what happened. Flames leapt up. When one will want to demand proof of the Normans. So maybe that's referring to some kind of group over there that attacked us. Okay, let's break this down line by line. John Hoag writes of this first line, at 45 degrees, the sky will burn. Well, Hoag is a Nostradamus expert. And Hoag writes this, does one brush it all off as a coincidence that the city of New York is near latitude 45 degrees? Well, I don't know about you. I have no problem brushing that off. I'll tell you why. The Twin Towers rested at 40 degrees latitude, not 45 degrees. So if this was predicting the latitude mark, it was off by 5 degrees. Well, give him a break. That's 500 years in advance. He's off by 5 degrees. To give you an idea of how far that's off, 45 degrees latitude is north of Toronto, Canada. Pull out Google Map. You can check that for yourself. That's how far it was off. Just think if you went into FBI headquarters on September 10th and said, I can prove that someone's going to attack a building. Well, where is it? Somewhere between Toronto, Canada, and New York City. Somewhere in there. Somewhere, or maybe 35 degrees. Could be anywhere in there. 1,000-mile span. Great job. Okay, line number two, fire to approach the great new city. Is this predicting New York City? Folks, it could refer to any city. It doesn't say New York City. It just says a new city. Any city could meet that description. Well, wait a minute. It says in an instant, a great scattered flame will leap up. Need I point out the obvious? All flames leap up. OK, that's the way flames go. They go upward. Well, what about one will want to demand proof of the Normans? The Normans invaded France before Nostradamus's time. This doesn't refer to Arabs or anything like that. This is a group that had invaded France in his period of history. In other words, this whole quatrain has nothing to do with 9/11 whatsoever. Well, what about the context? You know, when we read through biblical prophecy, we can see the exact context from beginning to end. We're not pulling things out of context. We see a general flow of thought. Well, what's the context for this prophecy? Well, we're in quatrain 97. Let's go back to 96. It says, the great city was abandoned to the soldiers, and except one offense, nothing will be spared it. That's gibberish. That's nonsense. It has nothing to do with 9/11 at all. Well, what about quatrain number 98, the one after it? It says there will be, quote, ruin for the Volcae and their great city. If you look at Leone's footnote, it's Toulouse, France. That's what the city of Volcae and their great city. It's not talking about New York at all. It's talking about an entirely different city of Nostradamus's time. Well, let's look at that other quatrain they try and use. Century 10, quatrain 72. The year 1999, seventh month, from the sky will come a great king of terror to bring back to life the great king of the Mongols before and after Mars to reign by good luck. You can see why they didn't like the second part of that quatrain, can't you? What is he talking? King of the Mongols? Bring back Mars? Good luck? What are you talking about? Let's look at the first line. The year 1999, seventh month. That's July 1999, not September 2001. Wrong. Wrong date. Actually, JFK Jr. died, I think it was July 16th, 1999. And they said, whoa, fulfillment of Nostradamus. That was in all the papers back then. Okay, obviously it can't be referring to JFK and 9/11. It has to be one or the other. Isn't it obvious it's not describing either? We're trying to make this fit retroactively. Well, it says, from the sky will come a great king of terror. Well, terrorists. Terrorists attacked us. Well, actually, in the original edition of Nostradamus in 1555, this actually says, from the sky will come a great appeaser king. This was translated from French. If you go back to the original copy, it's talking about an appeaser king, not a terrorist at all. Bring back to life the great king of the Mongols. Well, the word Angoulême is the Queen of Navarre east of Bordeaux. That's what that's actually referring to. If you go back to the original text, when he's referring to the Mongols, he's talking about an area in France. And I don't even know what the Mars thing has to do with anything, but skip over that. Before 9/11, there were four different interpretations of this quatrain. I'll just give you a few of them. Here we go. Number one, a great Mongol warlord. Number two, the third Antichrist. Number three, an airborne invasion of France. And number four, Muslim invasion of the Middle East. Isn't it clear that if you can have that wide of an interpretation of this passage, that it's not really predicting anything? It's gibberish. Nostradamus created his quatrains by, this is disputed, but some people say, he created his quatrains by getting drunk, hitting the bottle, and then writing all these words together, throwing them up in the air, and then scattering them on the ground and putting them all together in some astrological concept. That's why it sounds like gibberish. It jumps from one line to the next. Okay. When Nostradamus actually made a clear-cut prediction using dates rather than vague language, he was dead wrong. So normally he keeps it very vague. There's no context. There's absolutely no context to the quatrains, chronological or literary or otherwise. But when Nostradamus actually stuck his neck out to predict something specifically, he predicted that there would be horrific war, famine, and disease on June 22nd, 1732. What's interesting to point out is that even Nostradamus' supporter, Edgar Leone, said that at this time, Europe was in the very center of several decades of rare relative peace and prosperity. Not horror, famine, and disease. This is one of the few decades that Europe was actually pretty stable. So the first time he actually sticks his neck out, he's dead wrong. Well, before 9/11, they said, well, Nostradamus predicted Adolf Hitler. He predicted Hitler. I don't know if you ever read this, but it says it right there. Century 2, quatrain 24. Beasts ferocious from hunger will swim across rivers. This could be the panzer tanks or ships coming over. The greater part of the region will be against Hister. The great one will cause it to be dragged in an iron cage when the German child will observe nothing. So it's not Hitler, but it's Hister. That's pretty, I don't know, that's pretty close. Well, is that pretty close? The next quatrain, we're in quatrain 24. If you read the next quatrain, Hister joins with the Rhine River. Hister is a river. It's not a man in Nostradamus' thought. Even Stuart Robb in his book, Nostradamus Prophecies on World Events, he's a supporter of Nostradamus. He says, quote, Hister is an old, old name for the Danube River. It's not describing Hitler. It's describing the River Danube because it joins with the Rhine River. If you read the context, it's clear. And here you've got a supporter admitting that. And need I point out the obvious? Hitler is not the same as Hister. Those are not the same name. Give me a break. Other criticisms of Nostradamus. In 1882, Jean Guimon wrote that Nostradamus' language was, quote, so multiform and nebulous, cloudy, that each may find in them whatever he seeks. That's from Leone, Edgar Leone. 1867, La Peltier wrote, Nostradamus and his works are an enigma. All is ambiguous in Nostradamus, the man, the thought, the style. There lies no visible plan or method. All seems to be thrown together, pell-mell, in a universal mass of confusion. If you ever read through Nostradamus' centuries, you'll find that exact same conclusion. It's just describing these kind of random thoughts being thrown together. I think he's right. Even expert Edgar Leone, he is thought of, if you read James Randi, who is an incredible skeptic of Nostradamian prophecy, he says Leone is the cat's pajamas, okay? He is the man on Nostradamus. Edgar Leone writes in his book on page 110, quote, it seems that in the huge mass of predictions that can be found in the prose outline, there is not a single successful prophecy. Now, the centuries are not prose. Those are quatrains. Those are stanzas. In his prose literature, Leone admits when you actually have prose, things being described for real, there is not a single successful prophecy. The dating of two calamities serves to discredit him completely in this work. At best, it can be said of Nostradamus as a prophet that he occasionally had a successful vision of what would happen, but never of when anything would happen. So you can see he's really trying to salvage Nostradamus. He could never predict time, but maybe he could predict what he was seeing, something like that. Well, those are just two examples of how that was wrong. And I could also point out, you know, a broken clock is still right twice a day. If you wrote tons of these centuries, just countless lines of predictions, eventually you'd have to have something kind of right. Okay? Any one of us could do that, given enough guesses. Well, what about Edgar Cayce? Let's move on to another prophet, Edgar Cayce. Edgar Cayce was a 20th century psychic who diagnosed illnesses for people thousands of miles away. He was very popular back in the 30s, right in there, beginning of the 20th century. Casey, who claimed to be a Christian, he said he read the Bible every year, straight through. He also claimed to be the reincarnated warrior of Troy, a disciple of Jesus Christ. I believe he thought he was Luke. He thought he wrote the Acts of the Apostles and the Gospel of Luke. He claimed to be an Egyptian priest, a Persian monarch, and a heavenly angelic being. Makes you wonder why he couldn't have just been like an average guy, like one of us. He was called the sleeping prophet because he would make his predictions in a trance-like state. Casey would close his eyes and go into a trance, and then he would start to predict the illnesses that people had, and he had kind of a clairvoyant ability to predict people's ills. James Randi refers to these trance-like states in this way. On page 43, he says, Casey's trances were, quote, admittedly indistinguishable from sleep on occasion, sometimes even accompanied by snoring. I actually like this guy a lot. He was a former magician. He's an atheist. He's a skeptic. But he goes through and does really good work on debunking a lot of these fraudulent claims of the supernatural. So he has a book there, an encyclopedia of claims, frauds, and hoaxes, the occult and the supernatural. Well, what about Edgar Casey? In 1934, Casey predicted that Poseidia, a portion of the lost city of Atlantis, would rise from the Atlantic Ocean in 1968 or 1969. He predicted that California would break off and fall into the Pacific Ocean in the 1970s. There's a real fervor in that period of history that was going to happen. And he predicted, one, that Europe would change in the, quote, twinkling of an eye. Two, land off the east coast of America would arise. And three, the poles would shift sometime between 1958 and 1998. Well, Casey died in 1945, so he didn't get to see the looks on people's faces when none of this came true. Predicted all these things ahead of time that never happened. What about Gene Dixon, a clairvoyant, a psychic of the 20th century? In 1953, Gene Dixon entered St. Matthew's Cathedral having a vision of a young, blue-eyed Democratic president being shot or dying in office. She said he would be, quote, assassinated or die in office. And this prediction appeared in Parade magazine on May 13, 1956, 7 years before JFK was killed. Quite a prediction, if you ask me. Well, I think first thing we can point out is that she didn't name Kennedy. She named a Democrat. Now, I don't know, maybe I'm offending some third-party voters here, but it's a 50-50 chance, okay? Either Republican or Democrat is going to win it. She just predicted Democrat. That's really not that good, 50-50. Secondly, many U.S. presidents have been attacked in office. Here's a list of people who were assassinated or attempted to be assassinated in office. Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, FDR, Harry Truman, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, Gerald Ford, George Bush 41, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush. Kind of feel like Billy Joel from We Didn't Start the Fire there. But, I mean, they've got tons of presidents were either killed or attempted to be killed in office. And many of them died in office. And all she said was they have to be assassinated or die in office. So you have a number of cases there of presidential candidates who were attempted assassinated or actually were assassinated, and some that died while in office as well. Being president of the United States is a dangerous job. Thirdly, we can point out she had many false predictions in this prophecy. Dixon said that this election would be dominated by labor, which it wasn't, and that it would happen not necessarily in the first term. Well, Kennedy was killed in his first term. She said not necessarily in his first term, probably the second. Well, that's when it did happen, going against her own claim. Norm Geisler writes this, quote, Gene Dixon was wrong the vast majority of the time. Indeed, even her biographer, Ruth Montgomery, favorable to her, admits that Dixon made false prophecies. She predicted, and he's quoting from her biography by Ruth Montgomery, She predicted that Red China would plunge the world into war over Kamoi and Matsu in October of 1958. She thought that labor leader Walter Reuther would actively seek the presidency in 1964. On October 19th, 1968, Dixon assured us that Jacqueline Kennedy was not considering marriage. The next day, Mrs. Kennedy wed Aristotle Onassis. She's not considering marriage. Papers the next day said she's married. Quote, she also said that World War III would begin in 1954, the Vietnam War would end in 1966, and Castro would be banished from Cuba in 1970. Boy, Castro's beat all of the predictions anyone's ever made. Still over there with his finger in the air. Skeptic James Randi. James Randi writes this. Gene Dixon predicted that a comet would strike the Earth in the mid-80s, which she said would be, quote, known as one of the worst disasters of the 20th century. What about modern psychics? What about Jonathan Edward? He had a show called Crossing Over years ago. Anyone watch that show? Jonathan Edwards' show, Crossing Over. He was a psychic. Today, even though he had his show canceled, Edwards still charges $750 per hour for psychic counsel. He has a waiting list, I think, of 18 months. Celebrities are waiting to see Jonathan Edwards. That's how bad they want to talk to him. Well, the reason why Edwards' show was canceled was James Underdown, a skeptic, brought a team of investigators into his show to see if he was actually a psychic or not. And in this article from the Chicago Tribune, Underdown is quoted as saying, quote, we recorded everything in studio and compared it to what aired. They were substantially different in the accuracy. So he would ask one thing with a person and they would cut and splice the show in such a way that it would appear that he was making accurate predictions, but he really wasn't. You know, it would be nice if they had that show on live. They should have done a live show. Wouldn't have been able to do that. He writes, quote, they're getting rid of the wrong guesses. Once you pull back the curtain and see how it's done, it's not impressive at all. They canceled the show. People are still paying close to $1,000 an hour to talk to him. What about modern psychics like Sylvia Brown? Sylvia Brown was the weekly guest of the Montel Williams show. She claimed to be roughly 90% accurate in her predictions. She said that she could predict with 90% accuracy events regarding missing persons and murder cases. Wouldn't that be nice? You could bring a psychic in and they could tell you where the body's hidden. Missing person, what happened? She could pick that up from the universe or whatever and figure it out. Well, this was debunked as well. This is from the Skeptical Inquirer, Volume 34. They write, quote, however, after an intense 3-year study, a team of investigators discovered that out of 115 cases, she was, quote, not even mostly correct about a single case. They followed her around for 115 cases. She was not even mostly correct about one case. Far from being 90% accurate, she was 0% accurate. O'Keefe and Wiseman, this is from the British Journal of Psychology from 2005. They write, quote, no evidence to support the notion that the professional mediums involved in the research were, under controlled conditions, able to demonstrate paranormal or mediumistic ability. You know, if this was true, we'd want to find that out. And people, secular people, would use this to help people from their view. This is out of bounds for a Bible-believing Christian, according to Deuteronomy 18. But people would want to know if this stuff was true. Well, this Journal of Psychology investigated it, and they showed time after time, if you read the article, that whenever they bring these people in under controlled circumstances, not that the psychic gets to set up the controls, but that the investigator gets to set it up, they never could once find something that would show a mediumistic or paranormal ability. Here's what James Randi writes. He says, quote, over a 4-year period, researchers examined predictions offered by major psychics working for the National Enquirer, the supermarket tabloid, there were 364 predictions, of which a total of 4 were correct. This means that the psychics, all of them top-rated professionals making money, were 98.9% wrong. They are all still in business, except for one who died. Judging from his record, death was probably unexpected. That's the thing about Randy. The New Age people and stuff really hate him because he's kind of this snarky, sarcastic skeptic. He really rubs it in people's faces, but I kind of like him. I'd like to hang out with him. James Underdown writes this on his website. You can look this up. He offers a $50,000 reward for anyone who can come in to his place and under controlled conditions perform something supernatural or paranormal. He says, "We'll release the results publicly, which will raise your profile immensely among those who doubt your claims. The true skeptics will have to take notice of you. Come and get it. I've got a check. I've got a blank name. Put your name in there. If you can do this, you can get 50 grand. If that's not enough, James Randi on his website offers $1 million. Now, this dude has been around for a long time. He looks like Father Time in that picture. He's been around for a while. He's been around the block. They give examples of all these phony psychics who say, yeah, we'll be out there in a little bit. And then there's always something that comes up. Cancellation, time change. One guy came out and he said, well, I'm just really jet lagged. I don't think I'm really in my best ability to do this. You don't think you could get things together for $1 million? Deal with your jet lag for $1 million? Let's conclude here. Gleason Archer, PhD from Harvard in classics. Now, I'm not an expert in world religion. He is. He, before he died a couple years ago, Archer, I think, knew around a dozen dead languages fluently. He studied in Harvard. He's been around forever. In his 2007 book, Survey of the Old Testament Introduction, he writes this: occurrence of prophecy in the Holy Scriptures is unique among all the purported scriptures of non-Christian religions. This is unique. The Bible alone has prophecy like this. Archer writes, to reject such an overwhelming body of evidence as this and to hold to a theory of mere human authorship is to forsake all reason and logic, scarcely worthy of honest scholarship. I think he's right. I've never been able to find another religion, a psychic, anything like it. If you could find it, let me know. I would be so interested to find that out. I have never been able to find anything like that. Well, do you have any questions over any of that stuff that we covered? Yeah. Yeah. How they dated them? Okay, so the question is, how do you date the Dead Sea Scrolls? Well, you can do carbon dating on the manuscripts, and they have done that. They've done specific dating for the manuscripts. But one of the most precise ways to date these documents is actually through literary evidence. So, to give you an example of that, let's say I handed you a random verse from Shakespeare's Hamlet. And then I handed you a random verse from Jay-Z, okay? And you compared those two types of English, you would know with a fair degree of certainty which one was from the Middle Ages and which one was from today. And in fact, language changes so much that you can actually be pretty precise in when a document was written because of the colloquial or common language at the time. And so a lot of the words that were used and the language that was used can be lined up in that way, but they can also be scientifically dated to that time period. So we can get a pretty exact date, both from scientific and literary arguments. Okay, the question is, what is the Masoretic text? The Masoretes were a type of Jewish scribes who lived around 1000 AD, just to make the numbers pretty round. And they were responsible for transmitting the Old Testament text. And we don't have quantity of Masoretic texts of the Old Testament, but we do have quality in their work. They were so anal about the way that they would pass on the Holy Scripture. First of all, they believed that if they screwed up a single line, a jot, or anything on there, they would go to hell. They thought they'd be judged because they were transmitting the word of God. They had methods of counting the entire line and the entire book. So let's say they're copying the book of Isaiah. They would know that this line had 17 words, this line had 15, this line had 13, 14, and they would go through and count up all of the words going down the line. So they had that memorized, 17, 15, 14, 13, 12, all the way down. Then they had the middle word known. So let's say in 66 chapters of Isaiah, let's say the middle word is somewhere in Isaiah 33, 15. And the middle word of the book of Isaiah was, I don't know, judgment or grace, or I don't know what word comes up a lot in that book. And what they would do is they would count 1,253 words forward. And if that word wasn't judgment, you know what they would do with the text? They would roll it up and burn it and say, start over. What we found is old manuscripts from the Masoretes that were given to school children that they didn't even view as valuable because they were thrown away and they were such rubbish, according to them. So while the Masoretes wrote in the about 1000 A.D., when we compare the way they transmitted those documents with the Dead Sea Scrolls, what we found is that the Masoretic text is almost identical with what we find in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So in other words, for a while you would think our earliest date for these books is 1000 A.D. That's not very much. That's not very early. But when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, we found that they had faithfully transmitted these books over an 1100 or 1200 year period almost perfectly. And so the Masoretic text for that reason is one of the central texts that we use when we translate the Bible. But they also use the Septuagint and everything else. They put them all together. So, yeah. That's a good question. So why did these non-Christian, hostile to Christianity, why did these non-Christian historians try and interpret Daniel 9 to refer to Vespasian or Titus or whomever? Well, historians point out that Josephus, first of all, was a believer in the Old Testament. He was a believer in the Hebrew Bible. But he thought, or he said, that Titus or Vespasian or whomever fulfilled this prophecy because he was trying to get in good with Rome. Josephus was actually a Pharisee that was conquered by the Roman Empire. And Josephus, historians will tell you, was smart. He knew how to keep alive. So when they said, who is this prophecy referring to? And it's talking about the holy city and this conquering king and this anointed one. Who's it talking about? Josephus said, well, you, your majesty. Of course it was you who this Hebrew prophet was speaking of. And the same is true for Suetonius and for Tacitus and these other ones. I think that they, too, were just trying to appease the Roman Empire, even though they weren't believers in the Hebrew Bible. It would be something to help promote your cause to say that even these people spoke of us, the Romans, who were so powerful and great. That's a good question. Yeah. Okay, so the question is, some critics will say that the book of Isaiah was broken up into two or possibly even three different authors. The critics will break it up, Isaiah's chapter 1 through 39 is first Isaiah, and then 40 through 66 is Deutero Isaiah or second Isaiah. And some even tag on a treat to Isaiah, that there's three different authors for Isaiah. The reason they do that is because in Isaiah 44 and 45, Isaiah mentions by name King Cyrus, God's anointed, hundreds of years in advance. So if Isaiah was written before the Babylonian exile, he would be naming Cyrus by name, years in advance. So that's really the reason for doing that. However, the unity of Isaiah is phenomenal. There's no manuscript evidence that shows it broken up. And the literary evidence, I could get you some material on this, the literary evidence is flawless. The themes that are brought up in quote-unquote first Isaiah are also brought up in second Isaiah. And when we come to the Dead Sea Scrolls, Qumran, at Cave 1, we have all 66 chapters of Isaiah exactly as we thought it was written. So there's no manuscript evidence. And when we get to the New Testament, John 12:38 quotes second Isaiah, and then other parts where Paul and Romans 10 and all over the Bible, they quote it as one author, single authorship. So any way we look at it, it would still be predictive of Christ, even if it was post-exilic. Well, why don't we close down? We're getting out early tonight. Praise the Lord. 15 minutes to spare. Who wants to pray? We'll close down.